We have them 13 centuries and more before Christ. They were probably written on clay tablets long before that, for distorted versions of this story come from Babylonia of 4,000 years ago. Perhaps this story written on clay went in the saddlebags of Abraham when he left Ur of the Chaldees, long before Moses put it into the Pentateuch. But here it is. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath God said, Ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, Ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. And the serpent said unto the woman, Ye shall not surely die. For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. I want to speak to you this evening on the subject of temptation, which arose, those of you who are in Keswick will remember, from our Bible reading yesterday morning. But my discussion tonight will be no venture into psychology or theology. It will be no attempt, even in the fashion of a Bible reading, to explain difficult statements of Scripture which hedge this subject round. I want to be quite simple, very practical, and very personal. That's why I have read to you part of the third chapter of Genesis, so rich in vital truth. For that chapter tells us a great deal about temptation. Temptation always comes like the serpent, subtle, sudden, treacherous. Subtle? Note the seeming innocence of the first approach. Yea, hath God said, Ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden? The little flutter with evil sometimes appears so harmless, just this once. Could not the king walk on his own palace roof? Had he not, with the long toil behind his 50-odd years, the battling for people and for righteousness, had he not earned easier days? Was it not logical that he should be there in Jerusalem and not with his troops out on the campaign against Ammon? And surely the king could look where he would, into the gardens round about. Subtle. Sudden. Joseph went into the house of Potiphar, leaving his tasks on the estate for a brief moment, and expected no swift, sharp attack such as fell on him. He was preserved in that day as David was not preserved, by his preparedness. His mind was not conditioned to the fall. He'd garrisoned the weak point in his defenses. Treacherous? And he said unto the woman, where was the man? The woman was taken alone, with her helpmeet absent. No one in whom to confide, no one with whom to discuss the temptation. Here at the beginning of all evil was that subtle, treacherous setting of the stage which we all know. Know so well if we've watched the processes of evil that we cannot but be convinced that there is a mind behind it all. A dark and plotting mind. Turn to the temptation of the Lord in the stories, almost identical, in Matthew and in Luke. I say almost identical, for you will notice one striking difference. The order of the temptation varies. 1, 2, 3 in Matthew, 1, 3, 2 in Luke. Why? Because for the 40 days, those three temptations came, 1, 3, 2, 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1, 2, 1, 3, rushing round and round the beleaguered fort, attacking here, there, 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 in every conceivable variety. Do you know that experience? Temptation, I say, comes like the serpent, subtle, sudden, treacherous. Temptation, like the serpent, lies in the path, ready to poison and kill those whom it can overcome. Man's innocence went that day, for there was half-truth in what the tempter said. Ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. Yes, they learned what good and evil was. And man has been learning it ever since, day by day and moment by moment, we are faced with the awful burden of that knowledge. Adam and Eve and the race that sprang from them were never the same from that day. The serpent poisoned and killed. And David's happiness died that night he walked on the palace roof. He was forgiven. He was restored, and the agony of the prayer of Psalm 51 was not unanswered in the compassion of God, but happiness was gone forever. Like the serpent, temptation comes everywhere, into every recess, and through all barriers. It's part of the blessedness of the New Zealand bush, the New Zealand forest, as I should say, in English vocabulary, that there are no serpents. You can walk over the tangled punga leaves, and you can push through the blechnum fern, and you can struggle through the manuka, and never fear a sudden lash of strong, swift muscles under the feet, and the sharp, burning pain of fangs plunged into the flesh. There's no death in our place of beauty, and no serpent may be imported into New Zealand even for a zoo. So should the world have been, but it is not. Temptation, like the serpent, lies in wait everywhere, in the home and abroad, at work and at play, in palace and in slum, in God's very sanctuary, in the crowd and when you're alone, in town and in country. And none are exempt from temptation as none are exempt from the serpent's attack. The serpent will strike the strong man, and he'll strike the little child. King David was tempted and fell. The youth Joseph was tempted and stood. The self-seeking, calculating Judas was tempted and fell. The sinless Christ was tempted and stood. Temptation frequently begins by exciting curiosity. The woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise. Here was something new. And beware of the temptation that comes thus. Look through the Bible and see its incidents. Life was vivid and rich in Sodom. The bare Judean hills had been chosen by Abraham, a place of scanty pasturage, where the sun beat hot, and down the vale of Jordan, through that great earthquake cleft that cuts the earth's surface, from the Jordan Valley down to the lakes of East Africa, there was tropic lushness, and rich and varied life, and ease for men where the fruits of the earth came readily. Life was vivid and rich as Lot looked down towards Sodom, and his family were all for the venture. And a closer look, thought Sodom, won't do any harm. What's the use of isolating the children thus? And Lot pitched his tent towards Sodom. We know how he ended. We know how the tent went nearer and nearer and into the vortex. The man who had once weakened was drawn in successive phases of weakness. The man who had once fallen was brought to fall again. And his children became inhabitants of Sodom in more senses than one. Life among the Philistines was cultured and sophisticated. The people who had come from Crete and had formed their colony on the Gaza Strip as early as the days of Abraham and had been mightily reinforced by a great migration when Crete fell in the latter part of the second millennium before Christ. These people were Europeans, heirs of an ancient civilization with art and philosophy and culture. And Samson was a man with a strong and active mind, and life appeared much more elegant, much more desirable down among the Philistines than among the austere and narrow-minded Hebrews in the hills. And Samson often found himself slipping down towards Gaza and getting to know the Philistines, the enemies of his people, a little better. And he ended by marrying a Philistine girl, and he ended eyeless in Gaza. Dead under the ruins of the temple, his strong arms in that last convulsion had torn down. The man who had once fallen was drawn by successive temptation into successive falls, until all his personality was overwhelmed. Let me say one pungent word. Our greatest security against sin is to be shocked by it. Eve intended only to taste. And many a disastrous moral crash has thus begun. The tempter offered enlarged experience. And sin in youth often begins right there. The body is mature. The instincts and desires themselves not ignoble are strong and vehement in the flesh. And the horrible whisper in the soul suggests that the years are passing. And a joy which is a right is being lost. God was not depriving Eve and Adam of an enriching good, as he's not depriving young men and women of an enriching good by demanding morality and self-control. God no doubt intended to give all this knowledge to Adam and to Eve when they were able to appreciate it. Give all when it could be given, enriched by victory and sanctified by discipline. And that is true of the temptations which you are facing. You in youth and you in later years. Let us beware in the day of temptation of three things. Distrusting God's goodness. The whole burden and psychology of the serpent's attack in the third chapter of Genesis rested upon the doubt that God was good. Yea, hath God said, I'm surprised. When there's so much of which he's thus depriving you, ye shall not surely die, but God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened. All those words, they've echoed down the centuries, and they echo in every tempted soul. But don't distrust God's goodness. The best, lies in victory. And you're deprived of nothing that is worthwhile in life by being upright, pure and clean, and you win immeasurable good. Secondly, don't chafe at God's delays. He always seems slow. There's a poignant line even in an old Greek play written over four centuries before Christ, when Menelaus says to Orestes, never mind, Apollo will come in time to help you, and Orestes says, Melai, toyutos estite fusai. He takes his time, that's the way with him. And so often the tempted soul feels that God takes his time, that's the way with him. And maybe it is. Maybe it takes time for us to learn the discipline of patience. Maybe it takes time for us to learn self-control and discipline. But let our prayer be, Lord, teach me the lesson quickly that I may be left free from this schooling. And don't sweep God's provisions, there's my third thought, petulantly aside, or regret will be yours. God seeks not to deprive, but to protect. And to taste that which God withholds is the way to misery. Much mental breakdown, much suicide, and multitudes of broken lives come because in moments of madness, men try to taste that which God withholds. The wages of sin is death. That which we sow, we shall also reap. They are solemn truths, woven into the very texture of life and experience, and cannot be avoided. Let us have in our last 7 minutes, some practical conclusions. First of all, remember and take this thought and hold it fast, young people. Temptation is not sin. That is why Christ was tempted in all points like as we are. I cannot explain all the mysteries of Christ's temptation. But let this remain a truth. The one who stands, he alone knows the full strength and impact of temptation. The serpent in the path is no indication that the path is not the one which leads to your goal. Temptation is not sin. And then secondly, realize that temptation is not your peculiar affliction. You are one with the race. You who sit in the seats in this great tent are one with the preacher behind the rostrum and those who sit on the platform. We are all together in this. We all know the impact and the fury of temptation. We all know its drag and power. All of us, one and all of us. You are one with the race. Thirdly, in these disconnected, but I hope practical observations, temptation should not be courted. Kill the serpent, don't stroke it. Fourthly, you should run away from temptation. Don't stop to parley. Sometimes temptation is best avoided by putting actual distance, yards and miles, between yourself and it. And if the temptation is bound up somehow with a person, and in that person's presence you can't get over it, put the length of the land or half the world between you. Run away. Don't stop to parley. A friend of mine, whom you know, who has stood on this platform, told me of a temptation that was suddenly presented to him as it was presented to Joseph. In a San Francisco hotel. Oh, his first instinct, take his Bible. Show this girl some verses. He thought better of it. He rushed to the door, he rushed down the stairs, and he went out into the street, and that's the best way. Run away, don't stay to parley. Temptation overcome leads to greater strength and wider experience. You remember the story in that fantasy of C.S. Lewis? On the borders of heaven, where there was a poor wretch walking with a red lizard on his shoulder. And an angel of light came up and said, "Let me break its back." And the lizard whispered into the ear of the man, "No, no, no, the wonderful things I tell you, the images I put into your mind, let me break its back," said the angel of light. "Oh, well, go on," said the man. The angel took the serpent, broke its back, and flung it on the ground, and it turned into a mighty stallion on which the man, now free, leaped and galloped towards the mountains of light. The psychologists call it sublimation, but the spiritual truth in it. Let me give you one last illustration of how to meet temptation. Paul tells us that we war against grim powers, and that we should take the shield of faith and the helmet of salvation. And he mentions them side by side, and he was picturing the Roman soldiers that were marching through the town, legion after legion of them, because they were off to the Parthian frontier, where Corbulo in that very year was making another attempt to try and arrange that most difficult frontier of Rome. And the soldiers were going down with their long, curved, square shields slung on the left shoulder and their helmets hanging over their right. And he pictured them in battle with the darts of the Parthians. The Parthians were great horse archers clanging on the shield. And he knew how the Roman soldier fought because he'd talked to the men who were with him on guard in his hired house. And he knew they had to keep the shield up thus on the bent arm, flung out 45 degrees from their knees and high up so that they just looked over it. And there it was up to protect the legs and up to protect the face, and he knew that the helmet was down on the head and its rim low over the eyes, and that the head must not be thrown back. That's how Goliath died, laughing at David. Keep the helmet down and the shield up and the eyes just looking across the top of the shield, and then you were safe as you fought with your sword. There was no sudden slash across the face, across the brow, which filled the eyes with blood and led to death. You see what Paul meant? When you're tempted, remember that you're a Christian, the helmet down over your head, and not forgotten, despising your foe. It's a fierce enemy. Keep the helmet down, remember you are his, and the shield of faith up high, so that the shield of faith your day-by-day experience, allied with the ever-present memory that Christ died for you to save, and bind around with safety the sources of your thought and life, those two together will enable you to withstand all the fiery darts of the evil one.